Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW FM 91.7 in San Francisco. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden. We've looked at immigration from perspectives ranging from sympathy or vilification to undocumented aliens. What happens to non-citizens who face criminal charges? All important topics, but those are discussions for another night. In many areas of commerce, we have a leg up. We have an educated workforce. We can draw on wealth, natural and human resources, and ingenuity. There are areas where business needs somebody special. Alternatively stated, where the industry requires certain positions to be filled by persons with a particular expertise, where a certain skill or talent might be in short supply or wholly unavailable here, and we need to conduct not a nationwide but a worldwide search. Tonight we're talking about immigration law as it relates to those individuals, business immigration, that is, immigration for the benefit of commerce. As always, we're eager to hear what's on your mind and to answer your questions. You may call regarding any question on tonight's topic or any question relating to immigration. You're not limited to the exact point we may be in our conversation. As always, my guests are happy to share with you their expertise, to answer your general questions, and to lend guidance to this vital area. However, even attorneys must stop short of giving you precise legal advice on your case, as we don't have sufficient information about your case, all the facts that would be needed. Give us a call. Our number in the studio is 415-841-4134. Again, 415-841-4134. If you're in the Bay Area or if you're outside of the local dialing area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. And with that, let me introduce tonight's guests. Justin Falk is the lead attorney and founder of Falk Immigration Law, a boutique immigration law firm with offices in San Jose and San Mateo. The firm is devoted to helping companies, employees, and families navigate the increasingly complex United States immigration system. Justin currently manages the investor-based and family-based immigration cases at the firm and also heads the firm's response for employers adversely affected by the recent COVID-19 immigration restrictions. Anita Komarikian is a partner and attorney at Alcorn Immigration. Anita loves using the power of the law to help people erase borders so they can achieve their full potential. With a passion for helping people, she helps both families as well as employers bring individuals to the U.S. to pursue visas, green cards, or citizenship. As an immigrant to the United States, she identifies with her clients and is passionate about helping families stay together and reunite in the United States. She understands firsthand the struggles families face navigating the U.S. immigration law system. Christian Everez is a partner in the Santa Clara office of Fagoman Worldwide, working in all areas of corporate business immigration, including non-immigrant visas, labor certifications, and adjustment of status, serving as corporate immigration counsel to emerging and mid-sized clients in a wide range of industries. Christy served as congressional assistant and immigration policy advisor to Congresswoman Zoe Lofgren from 2010 to 2012. Saja Rofes represents companies who hire foreign nationals on non-immigrant and immigrant work visas. Based in San Francisco, she works with clients in STEM fields, including engineering, architecture, energy, tech, and medical research. Her career choice was informed by her family's immigration to the U.S. Her father's an alien of extraordinary ability. One and all, let me welcome each of you to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.
Christy, maybe you could help get us started. Can you give us a brief interview? When we're talking about business immigration, just what are we talking about?
Well, you shouldn't give me the mic for too long on this. I dedicated my career to for the last 25 years, so I'll have my final fellow panelists.
Not sure why, but I'm getting a lot of feedback.
I'm going to go ahead and tell you as quickly as I can, even though I could talk about this for hours. But really what we're talking about here is companies that are sponsoring foreign national employees for temporary work permits, primarily. That's how they first come in.
So far, so good.
Sometimes the companies want to extend their stay in the U.S. on a permanent basis, and in that case, they will sponsor the foreign nationals for a green card. But on the business side, there are a lot of different types of work permits, an alphabet soup, we like to call it, a whole bunch of different letters of the alphabet, like H-1B, L-1s, O-1s, T-Ns. Each of those statuses have specific requirements, some including degree requirements, position types, wage requirements. So there's a lot of different ways that you can come into the country under an employment-based sponsorship. And then if you want to stay longer for a green card, there's a lot of different ways that a company can sponsor you for a green card as well. There's five different categories. Some of my panelists can talk, you know, in more detail about some of those than others. But primarily, you have an opportunity to come to the U.S. if you are really the cream of the crop of your industry in the fastest way possible, the employment-based first preference. So Saja's dad, for example, was able to get to the green card, you know, through that fast process. For most other people, it requires a test of the labor market where companies have to prove to the government that there are no able, willing, and qualified U.S. workers to do the job. And so they ask the government to certify the position for a foreign worker. It could be a long, hard process, but that's kind of the Reader's Digest version from the employment-based side.
Thank you. That gives us a bit of background and helps explain why we're having this conversation tonight. But you brought up Saja's dad. Saja, let me ask you, shouldn't we be banning foreign workers from entering the U.S. if that means protecting job opportunities for Americans?
Thank you so much for having me on, and thank you for your audience for their interest in the very relevant topic right now. I completely understand the concern behind that question. However, there is no evidence that jobs work like a pie. There's actually evidence that immigrants create jobs. So just a few examples. There was a recent study by the National Bureau of Economic Research, and it analyzed data from Fortune 500 and the U.S. Census Survey of Business Owners for a 10-year period. And it found that immigrants tend to be employers rather than employees compared to U.S.-born individuals. And they also start companies at a much higher rate. And those companies experience significant growth. Those are just a few examples as to why immigration encourages the job market and stimulates the economy.
That would make sense. One would think that either people are coming here with resources in order to get something started, or alternatively, they're coming here pretty hungry in a way that maybe people that were born and raised here with some of the advantages we have wouldn't be. Anita, if a company wants to sponsor one of their employees for immigration purposes, what option do you recommend? What would be the fastest and most reliable?
Great question, Jeff. Thanks for having me. It all really depends. Like Christy said, immigration is an alphabet soup. So it's a matter of the individual that you're trying to support. So thinking creatively through that alphabet soup of figuring out what country is this person from, what is this person's accomplishments, and seeing what works in their best interest. A TN, for example, maybe for somebody who's coming in from Mexico or from Canada, an E3 maybe for somebody who's coming in from Australia, maybe a J-1 visa, an O-1 for somebody who is quote unquote outstanding. It all really depends. And I feel like I'm really just throwing letters out there. But it's all feasible. The ones that I just mentioned were all non-immigrant visa options for the most part. There's L's and H's that have dual intent visas, where those ones, H's specifically, can take a bit longer to enter into the United States because of the cap. because of the cap lottery for H-1Bs. But it all truly depends on the person. Maybe they're from the employer is a nonprofit and they want a petition and they're exempt from the cap, the H-1B cap lottery. Again, those are not immigrant options. There's also immigrant options. Maybe somebody is so incredibly outstanding, again, like Sasha's dad, and we want to give them an opportunity to come and be extraordinary in the United States. So we'll give them an easier or faster pathway towards getting their green card. So in a nutshell, it depends. And that's why there's people like Justin, Christy, Sasha, myself, where you can pick our brains to see what works best for you, and for your employees, for your family, and whatever it may be.
Justin, one of the types of visas we just heard that Anita just mentioned is the H-1B visa. First, I'd like you to tell us a little bit about what those are. But then we've heard in the news about them becoming more restrictive, a bit harder to come by. And if you could talk to us about the recent changes that have occurred and why that makes it more difficult for employers to get H-1Bs for their employees.
Sure. Thanks, Jeff. The H-1B is by far one of the most popular work-related non-immigrant visas. Generally speaking, an employer will sponsor an employee and they're allowed to work for a total of 6 years on their H-1B. We look at H-1Bs as kind of a gateway to a green card. And as I said, it's one of the more popular temporary work visas here in the U.S. Recently, just a couple weeks ago, the government has required or has significantly increased the salary that we have to pay to H-1B workers. In some cases, upwards of 40% of an increase for these salaries. So what's been happening is that it's been making this visa type a lot more restrictive because many employers are not going to pay the outrageous salaries that the government is requiring for this visa type. I think that's the main change that we're seeing right now that's causing a lot of consternation for our clients.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. Tonight, we're discussing business immigration with Justin Falk. Justin Falk is the lead attorney and founder of Falk Immigration Law. Christy Navarez is a partner in the Santa Clara office of Fragerman Worldwide. Sasha Roof is the principal at Sasha Roof Incorporated, a professional law corporation out of San Francisco. And Anita Kumrich, I'm sorry, I'm getting a little tongue-tied here. And Anita, I don't mean that. Anita,
that's Kumrich, an easy one to mess up, don't worry.
Is a partner and attorney at Alcorn Immigration Law. If you have questions for my guest, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the local dialing area, our toll-free number where we pick up the freight, 866-798-8255. Again, that's 866-798-8255. As always, you may call regarding any question on tonight's topic or any question relating to immigration, particularly that's immigration in furtherance of commerce. You're not limited to the exact point that we may be in our conversation. And again, that number is 866-798-8255. So with that, Christy, can you tell us a little bit about the green card system and tell us a little bit about why there's backlogs created for green card approvals?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a big topic. If you're a foreign national here in the United States, for people who decide that they want to make their home here, they want a little surety. They want to know whether they can buy a house. They want to know whether they can, have their kids educated in the United States. So having that longer term view is important. So if companies are willing to sponsor the foreign nationals for a green card, it's a great way to get started on that journey. It's a long journey for a lot of people. And, your listeners may be interested to know the speed of how you can do that depends on which country you were born in. The way that our employment-based immigration is set up, there's about 140,000 green cards that can be approved during any one fiscal year. And that 140,000 is divided by every country in the world and every employment-based category. So there's not any overrepresentation from any one country. They limit the number of green cards by those different groups. So on the employment-based side of immigration, we have some great representation from foreign nationals who were born in India and China. And because they have the same number of green cards allocated to those countries as Belgium, there's a line that creates. There's a backlog that's created for people who were born in those countries. Some people say, well, sure, I was born in China, but I have a passport from Canada. I'm a citizen of Canada. Can't that speed up the process? And the way that the rules are written in the statute is that this is determined by country of birth, not country of citizenship. So that's something that you cannot change. There's some people that predict if you were born in India, and depending on which category you're able to immigrate through, it could take multiple decades to get through the green card process, which, you know, if you think about that from, you know, from a human perspective, it's a long time to wait before you know that you have some assurance that you can stay in this country from a long-term perspective. So it's a tough road for people, for sure. I'm always amazed at people who are committed to seeing that process through and able to build that life here in the U.S.
So let me throw this out to the group and see who wants to jump in at this. What recourse is there? I individually, you may not be able to say this is taking too long, but I would think that globally there must be some response. Is there any litigation going on, or is there any acts in Congress to try to clean this up?
Well, maybe I can speak first about the litigation component. So Justin was talking about those, you know, kind of hot off the press new regulations that were issued just recently. And immediately we had a lot of advocacy groups, including AILA, which is the American Immigration Lawyers Association, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, TechNet, a lot of high-tech groups here in Silicon Valley and across the United States that says, wait, this isn't right. The way that you're rolling this out, it is not giving enough notice and comment period that's required by the Administrative Procedures Act, by the APA. So really quickly, I think groups were mobilized and started to file lawsuits. There's three different lawsuits going on right now in different jurisdictions. One filed right here in our San Francisco District Court, challenging both of those regulations on different kind of platforms. But really, the gist of it being that the way that the government rolled out these regulations was untenable and was against the rules of the APA. And the ask from these plaintiffs were to put a stop to it, to have an injunction being granted. And so that is in the works right now. But as Justin mentioned, for one of those rules, for that prevailing wage rule from Department of Labor, went into effect immediately. There was no notice. There was no opportunity for companies or advocacy groups to share any particular concerns that were going on. And so from a plaintiff's perspective, they said, look, we need this to be put on pause. We need to understand what the ramifications of this are. We have to go through the normal processes. And it'll probably be a while, though, if an injunction is granted by a judge. I think most speculation is that we wouldn't see anything until maybe the beginning of December. So for right now, at least on that Department of Labor rule, it is in effect. For the H-1B rule that talks about restricting the H-1B and narrows the definition of who qualifies for the H-1B specialty occupation, that's not supposed to go into effect until the beginning of December. So that might coincide nicely with any injunction that's there. So, that's my take on that.
Before I move on to different areas, is there anybody else that wants to be heard on that? It's scary.
I would add, as Christy mentioned, those who are most impacted by visa backlog to get a green card would be India and China. And throughout my career, I have seen lawsuits from Indian interest groups, from Chinese interest groups, suing the government to try to remove those backlogs. You know, the claim is that it's unfair that a Chinese worker might have to wait 10 years or longer, or an Indian worker might have to wait 10 years or longer to get their green card while other countries don't. From what I've seen of the lawsuits that I'm aware of, that really hasn't gone anywhere, because the way the government allots these visas is there's a 7% cap per country, meaning that no country can take up more than 7% of any of the worldwide visas. And if they do, then a line starts forming. China and India, being the most populous countries in the world, naturally a line starts forming for them because they have so many people applying for these green card slots. So yeah, to respond to your question about lawsuits for people who are delayed, at least for the in terms of a green card, for countries that are affected by these backlogs, I have not seen any lawsuits that have been successful over these years.
And I'll just add, if we have a minute, just on this point, the reason why companies are so interested in advocating for their foreign national employees and going to the lengths of filing lawsuits is, it's not because of any particular advantage that hiring a foreign national on a work visa brings. If anything, it's a very complicated, cumbersome, costly, lengthy, and exacting process to hire a foreign national on a work visa compared to a U.S. citizen. A U.S. citizen could begin on Monday. Today, if I'm a company and I want to hire a foreign national on an H-1B, I have to wait until next spring for the H-1B filing window to open. And I have to file. And if I am lucky and my petition gets selected and approved, the start date, the earliest, is October 1st, 2021. So I am looking at a year. And from a business perspective, of course, that's impractical. And this is just the regulations. This is just the way the work visa is designed. So it's not any kind of particular advantage or any kind of favoritism towards foreign national. It truly does come from business necessity.
And Sajja, I would also add that the employer also needs to pay our outrageous immigration lawyer fees as well, as a further detriment. Yep.
Mm-hmm. And it's not just our fees though too. It's the government filing fees as well. The bigger the company and the more foreign nationals that you hire, the higher the government filing fees are. And if you want to file with premium processing, if that's an option for you, where the government has to respond within 15 days, they'll charge you an arm and a leg for that. So I totally agree. It's not easy hiring a foreign national. The cost of it at the end of the day is worth it, because these people are coming and they're brilliant and they add so much to companies, and the companies don't think twice about jumping through those hoops of fire to hire these people. And there's positions in companies specifically for global mobility where that's all they do. They focus on, who am I hiring that's a foreign national? When does their visa expire? What do I have to do next for them?
So some of the larger firms have to have people on staff, mm-hmm, that monitor their workforce as a whole and keep a track of all that. When you mentioned about, and I think it was Sajja that mentioned a minute ago about it taking so long, and right now they're backed up to October of 2021, I assume that that's with a prospective worker, waiting overseas for the chance to come here?
Either overseas, or they could be currently in the U.S. on another status. Go ahead.
But they don't get to come here while that application is pending. If they're not here for some other reason, they're waiting abroad and you're waiting a year before you can start your employee?
Correct. Assuming there are no delays at the embassy or consulate stage.
Which we've seen a lot of with COVID over the past 10 months, right?
And to clarify, Jeff, it's not necessarily a backlog that is forcing these people on H-1Bs to start on October the 1st. October the 1st of every year is the beginning of the fiscal year. So when individuals are applying for an H-1B visa through the CAP lottery process, it's for a prospective fiscal year. So right now we'll be working on CAP on the fiscal year of next year. So in spring when we apply of 2021, we'll be applying for fiscal year 2022. So it's just, that's just when the fiscal year kicks in, and that's when these people have the ability to actually start their employment.
Maybe we'll take a minute, though. I can throw it out to some of my panelists. What about people who are already here on an H-1B and then they find another job with another employer? You know, how are you guys managing that? What is that time period looking like?
I can take that. So it's, if we're going to just be going from one employer to another employer and you're already in H-1B status, then it's just a transfer that you would be filing. And that transfer, if there is the option of premium processing, you can get a response within 15 business days. They just recently changed it. And so with that, you'll get a decision within 15 days. Some people can take the riskier pathway of starting employment upon receipt of the application, which under administration now, it's really not recommended for some, depending on how conservatively you want to approach it. So it can be as soon as filing the application. So I would say realistically, as soon as like 2 to 3 weeks to start. But again, it's risky.
Have you folks been seeing a lot of employers balk at taking on new H-1B cases because of the increase in the prevailing wage? That's been a huge problem for us at our firm.
You know, the one thing that is actually helping, I think, and kind of rooted into more real life world that we're in is private surveys. So some companies and their comp department use private surveys, not just for foreign nationals, but just to gauge employment offers for all of their employees. And depending on the breadth of that survey, that has been a solution for a lot of companies. But I think I would go back to what Justin and what everyone had said earlier. If employers could avoid hiring foreign nationals, they would, but they can't. There's just not the talent, especially in the high tech world, that we have of U.S. workers that these companies need. I mean, I can speak for myself. All of my, you know, colleagues in college, I graduated with an English major. I'm surrounded by philosophy and sociology majors that, you know, all my friends who were born here in the U.S. like me, I didn't have a whole lot of friends that studied in the STEM field. So there was certainly a need to, you know, to sponsor people where that is their area of expertise. But, you know, I think companies are going to have to do what they have to do in order to keep their businesses successful.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. Tonight, we're discussing business immigration with Anita Kamrikian. Anita is a partner and attorney at Alcorn Immigration Law. Justin Falk is the lead attorney and founder of Falk Immigration Law. Christian Neverez is a partner in the Santa Clara office of Fragaman Worldwide. And Saja Rauf is the principal at Saja Rauf, Inc., a professional law corporation in San Francisco. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the local dialing area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic, any question relating to immigration, that is immigration and furtherance of commerce. You're not limited to the exact point we may be in our conversation. You're listening to Your Legal Rights. We'll be back right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information. Once again, 415-989-1616 or sfbar.org.
Sasha, you were talking about the length of time it's going to take once you apply, that nothing's going to happen until the beginning of the next fiscal year. If you're already lawfully here on a different status, does that clock the time over the that the employee can stay here? Does that somehow buy them time if their present status is running while waiting for the other status to start?
So in order for them to be able to change status, they have to have valid non-immigrant status until the petition is adjudicated. So for example, if I am on, say, an L2 visa and a company files for me, as long as my L2 is valid through the beginning of the H-1B validity period, I can change status from L2 to H-1B and not need to leave the U.S. and obtain a visa from overseas. If my status will expire sooner than that, or if I'm not maintaining status, I would have to go through the consular process and apply for a visa before I can start on an H-1B in October.
Let me turn it to David from San Mateo. David, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thanks, Jeff. Great topic tonight. I have a question about the temporary business visa, the B-1 visa. Who would be eligible for a dependent visa? Would a spouse or children be eligible?
Hey, David, could you clarify the question? You mean if someone was getting a B-1 or B-2 to enter the United States, could they also bring their spouse and their children?
Exactly.
Yes, yes.
Okay. Yeah, each individual person would have to apply for their own visa. They're not spouses and children are not looked at as dependents in the traditional sense. So each person would have to apply for their own tourist visa to get in, or B-1 or B-2 visa to get in.
I see. Would it typically be the tourist visa that the spouse and children would apply for?
Yeah, so typically, yeah, if you had the father applying for a tourist visa or a business visa, B-1 or B-2, to come into the United States, and you want the whole family to come along, yeah, they would follow suit with the same type of visa.
I see. And can you tell me what would be the typical time for that process to take place? How far in advance should they apply for that?
To give you the lawyerly answer, it depends. It really depends on which country you're applying from. Some countries have embassies that are much quicker to take interviews for the B-1, B-2 visas. And some countries are completely shut down and you can only get emergency appointments. So yeah, it just really depends on which country you're coming from.
And what are some of the factors that go into it being denied or accepted?
In our experience, the first and foremost reason for denial is because they don't believe you have enough ties to your home country to return after visiting the United States. And what that means in plain English is that, you know, if I come to the United States, how do I show you that I have enough ties back home that will drag me back home and that I won't stay in the U.S. because things are so great in the United States, is the way the government looks at it. So they're looking for things like, do you have a job? Are you paying a lease on your apartment? Do you own property? Do you have a business? Are you going to school back at home and you're only coming for a short break? There's a bunch of factors they look at to determine whether or not you're going to be coming home or not after you visit the United States.
I see. Thank you very much. That's very helpful.
David, thank you for joining us. And before we go further, let me turn it to Howard from San Jose. Howard, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Good evening, everybody. Thanks for doing this. Thank you. I have a question about a friend of mine who is born in the United States, but who has immigrant parents. It has to do with how the immigrant parents' names are spelled, because they come from a country that doesn't use English, and so I presume they've either had to transliterate or take on a new name when coming into the country. And my friend needs to find out what the legal spelling is in order to get some identification document. But he is estranged from his parents, so he cannot find out directly from the source. So is there any way you guys know to find out how this person's name is supposed to be spelled?
One thing that your friend could consider doing, Howard, if I think I fully understood your question, was possibly if they're in the United States and already have some immigration paperwork started with the government, is by filing a FOIA, a Freedom of Information Act, to see what the government has on file for your friend, to see what the spelling of the name is. It may be a little bit difficult if they don't know exactly the spelling of names, if I understood your question correctly. But that could be a good start.
Okay. Freedom of Information Act. And I guess that's, which, do you know what part of the government I would be petitioning for the information from?
With that, I'm not entirely sure, because I don't know exactly the facts of your friend's case, and that's a pretty specific question. I'm sorry, Howard. But you can kind of throw FOIAs at all agencies to see what sticks. So filing with USCIS, filing with Customs and Border Patrol, there's an open FOIA that can be filed as well, that's done through fingerprints.
All right.
Yeah. Give it a shot.
Thanks a lot, guys. Appreciate
thanks for joining us. And Howard, if an attorney will have some of those different agencies, some of their different contact information and the forms you can use for a Freedom of Information Act request. So it wouldn't be a bad thing to refer your friend to have somebody that can assist. If it's somebody that is not in a position to pay a private attorney, they can always seek the assistance of the local bar association closest to him or her that can assist.
Okay, that's very helpful as well. Thank you very much, guys.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us.
Jeff, if I could say one other thing as far as referrals, that group that I mentioned earlier, AILA, it's the American Immigration Lawyers Association. It's AILA.org. If someone wants to find an attorney who specializes in immigration specifically, that's also a good place to start.
We had been talking a bit off the air. One of the things that we talked briefly about is the cap on immigrants from particular geographic regions. One of the things that came to mind is that by limiting it by region, it might not meet all the needs of some of our businesses that need people with particularized skills. And it seems as though that might create a mismatch, if so to speak, to where some of our needs aren't being met. Am I off track on that, or is that a growing problem?
I think that is a problem, Jeff, because of that quota, of that visa bulletin, at least from a longer term perspective, right? For people who are interested in long-term stay in the United States, it does get a little bit, restraining for the foreign nationals that are here, because for most of those alphabet soup temporary work permits that we're talking about, there is a finite amount of time that you can stay in the country on those temporary work permits. They are by definition temporary. Some of them have longer stays than others, but unless you can proceed to a certain level of the green card process, then your time is limited here. And it goes back to the same problem that I think that we kind of outlined at the beginning. Having some surety to be able to stay here becomes hard if you're always looking at the calendar and calculating how much time you have left. And again, the wait can be very long depending on which country you're from.
I'd like to shift.
Point. Yeah.
Go ahead, Justin.
I would add to that, when you make skilled foreign nationals wait over a decade to get a green card, they will start looking at greener pastures. I mean, it's a natural human instinct. So why would I come to America and wait 10 years to get a green card when I can go to Canada and get one much quicker? And case in point, the visa bulletin has jumped up considerably in October, because people from India and China, the countries where there's that long wait time, less people have started applying. So the line is getting shorter, because we're making this country so unattractive to skilled foreign labor because we're making them wait so long.
Let me jump in and interrupt you for just a minute, Justin. Tell us what that bulletin is.
Sure. The Visa Bulletin is a monthly release from the Department of State that tells us how many visas for that particular month they're going to issue. To put it in its most simplest form, I think I would say that it's a estimate as to how many visas are going to be released for that particular month based on historical trends, and how many visas are left for that particular country for that particular year. So each month, if you're a foreign national hoping to get a green card, especially if you're from China or India, you'd be every month logging in to look at the visa bulletin to see how far your case has moved up in terms of the wait time.
So from this, you could extrapolate, it sounds like, a lot of information if they're timely releasing the information with these bulletins. And in
Correct.
Talking to you before the show, and I see Anita smiling, it sounds like there's been some problem with this month's bulletin. Did they not give us timely notice?
They did not. We are actually still waiting for our visa bulletin to be published. Typically, visa bulletins are published around the 15th of each month. It is now, in the spirit of spooky Halloween season, almost, it's the 28th, and we have yet to see the visa bulletin. I know Christy was speaking a bit about this earlier. It's wild. So we're waiting to see what's gonna come of the November visa bulletin. The October visa bulletin was a doozy. If any of the panelists want to talk about their experience with the October visa bulletin, but a lot of the categories, or one of them specifically, jumped by 5 years.
When you say jump by 5 years, you mean people that are looking to track their application and to make their plans suddenly learned that their process has been delayed 5 years?
Actually, the opposite. Yeah.
So some people that were looking at a prolonged stay suddenly found out, if you're ready to jump right now, we're giving you a 5-year jump from what you had thought a while ago.
To put it in perspective, so that visa bulletin that we've been talking about on a month-to-month basis usually goes ahead by days. Every once in a while, it'll go ahead by weeks at the beginning of the fiscal year, as we mentioned, which is October. And this year, this month, rather, as Anita mentioned, for at least for people who were born in India in the employment-based third preference or the EB3, it moved ahead 5 years, 4 years and 11 months to be exact. So people who were looking and maybe were just, you know, a month or two away from their date being current, when they logged on at the end of September and saw the October visa bulletin, there were thousands, tens of thousands of people whose date became current 5 years sooner than they anticipated. In addition to thousands of immigration lawyers going, oh my goodness, we have 5 years worth of cases to file very, very quickly while that window stays open. Because from a month-to-month basis, those dates and opportunities can change. So, of course, the anxiety is there to make sure that green card applications are filed as quickly as possible, which, you know, we all appreciate and understand. It's a huge opportunity for green card applicants that have been waiting, you know, a decade to file, to have this window open up. It's just same problem we talked about with the regulations. It's the notice period where the government has been, you know, lacking in this effort. We still haven't seen the November visa bulletin on this Halloween time, as Anita said. So they're 2 weeks late, in my opinion, from the way I see it. They're 2 weeks late with the November visa bulletin to know kind of what's happening as we go ahead as well.
So let me go to some very basic stuff. Time's running a little bit short. Anita, let me ask you, if my employer has filed an application or a petition on my behalf, can a family member also file a petition for me at the same time?
I think all of us are obligated to answer or start the answer to a question with, it depends. For the most part, it depends. Typically, you can have two parallel pathways going for immigration, so long as it's a dual intent type visa. So, for example, if somebody's in the United States on an H-1B visa and they get married to a United States citizen and they want to file a green card based off of their marriage while they're in H-1B status, that's feasible because with an H-1B visa, it's okay for you to have immigrant intent, even though it's also partially a non-immigrant visa. If somebody's in the United States on a purely non-immigrant visa, maybe like an O visa, the outstanding abilities visa, it can be a little bit tricky to know whether or not it's safe for you to have a family petition for you as well. So can it be done? Yes, but it depends.
So the best lawyer advice I could tell people would be to tell people that they should talk to a lawyer because their particular case may give them a different answer than it would for 98 out of 100 people out there.
Precisely.
Sasha, we were talking earlier. Can you mention a few of the ways that the pandemic has impacted business immigration?
Sure. So while everyone has been dealing with the health aspect and the financial aspect that the pandemic has taken on our lives, foreign nationals in the U.S. have also had to deal with the immigration consequences. There have been very few accommodations extended to foreign nationals and their employers. Since the pandemic started, the difficulty of travel has made it difficult for foreign nationals to leave the U.S. on time. They've had to look into options for extending or changing their status because there was no amnesty on people overstaying against their will and voluntarily, simply because they could not leave the U.S. The grace period for many work visas is 60 days, during which a foreign national has to either figure out their options or leave. So the lack of flexibility that we've seen in the business immigration context is a continuation of the policy, the executive order issued in April 2017 called Buy American, Hire American, which made things exponentially more difficult for our clients in business immigration.
Justin, while we're on that subject, the president suspended travel from some certain countries due to COVID-19. What countries are currently on that list?
Sure. So from January to May, when the coronavirus really grew in severity, President Trump issued 5 presidential proclamations suspending entry from certain countries because of COVID-19. So as we sit here today, you cannot directly enter the United States if you're coming from either China, Iran, the UK, Ireland, Brazil, and a country within the Schengen area, which is a geographic area comprising of 26 countries that pretty much contains all of the EU. And these are our closest international buddies, France, Germany, Spain. To put this in context, one of my colleagues was really bored at the office one day and counted how many people live in these countries. So these presidential proclamations have barred 2 billion people from directly entering the United States. And we've literally suspended direct entry in the U.S. for a third of the population of the world. This suspension means that you cannot directly come to the U.S. from one of these countries. What you have to do in order to get in is you need to leave one of the countries on the list, go to a country that's not on the list, hang out there for 14 days, and then you're allowed to come into the U.S. Obviously, this is going to have, as international trade opens up, this is going to have a huge impact on our economy. And also, you know, with the holidays coming up, it's going to really restrict a lot of travel for people who want to go home and visit their families.
You know, a couple minutes ago, you were talking about the visa bulletin and how so many people have moved up. Christy, is there a reason? I mean, is there a policy that you're aware of as to why we've seen such a surge in the ability to file adjustments of status with the October visa bulletin?
Yeah, there is. It's not necessarily just a surge, you know, for surge's sake, just to drive the immigration attorneys crazy and to have us react really quickly. It's really because of what's happened this year with the pandemic. So I think I mentioned earlier for the on the employment based side, there's 140,000 green cards that are able to be approved during the fiscal year. This year, there's 250,000 available, and that's because of a spillover of the unused green card numbers from during this year because of the travel bans that Justin just talked about, processing slowdowns. Everyone is having skeletal staffs. Green cards just weren't getting approved. People weren't traveling. So all of those spillover numbers that weren't used before have been added to this year's numbers. And so all of a sudden that visa bulletin opened up in a huge and a very quick way. Part of the big news, though, that with this visa bulletin, it wasn't just the advancement of the numbers, but it was in which category those numbers advanced. So if the EB3, the employment-based third preference, which is typically the slowest of, you know, 1, 2, and 3, they go in priority order, that EB3 category jumped a lot further ahead than the EB2 category, which that's where a lot of the numbers are coming from right now. So it's really, you know, it's really because of the COVID situation we've been dealing with for the last 7 months.
You know, we've been talking a lot about employees of different types and what employers can do. Saja, I'll ask you, what are some of the challenges that international students are facing right now?
So typically, international students on an F1 student visa are required to have no more than one online course per semester in order to maintain their F1 status. When the pandemic began, an exception was made to allow more flexibility since everyone started sheltering in place. However, there was a directive by ICE that rescinded that basically and required international students to either enroll in a school that can offer all of their courses in person or leave the U.S. or face removal proceedings. The academic world was reacted swiftly and the directive was eventually canceled. But this would have been a health hazard for the schools. It would have really put an obstacle in the futures of their students. There were a lot of practical considerations that were not taken into account when that directive was briefly in effect.
Well, we're basically out of time. I'd like to give each of you a chance for any closing thoughts. And if there's anything also in terms of recent developments that we may have missed that you want to go over in really short order, please feel free. Justin, you want to go first?
Sure. You know, taking these past 4 years into consideration, I think all of my colleagues on the panel would agree with me that we have never seen so many changes happen so quickly in immigration law. I think it's been really difficult for employers and foreign workers to keep up with all these changes. So I guess if I could leave our listeners with one piece of advice out of the 500 pieces of advice I'd want to give them, it would be to definitely talk to your immigration attorney before any international travel. These past 4 years, we've seen at least 10 presidential proclamations and executive orders restricting international travel in some way. This seems to be an area that the Trump administration is really focusing on to restrict immigration. So, you know, with the holidays coming up, people are going to want to travel, visit mom and dad. Just if you do that, please be sure to check with your immigration lawyer before you do to make sure that it's safe to do so.
Saja, would you like to go next?
Sure. So I invite listeners to move beyond the rhetoric and look at the facts and look at what immigrants bring to this country. And I remind all of us that there's not one time in U.S. history that involved immigration restriction that we look back fondly on.
Anita, how would you like to jump in?
I don't know if I can follow that up. That was really good. I mean, just to mimic both Justin and Saja, as an immigrant myself, call me biased, but I think we're great. And just a matter, it's a matter of being open-minded, being supportive, and just knowing the resources available to you. Seek those resources, ask questions, and immigration attorneys, we're all here to support you. And we're all on the same team. We all want to make sure that you can live your dream, whether it's living your dream in the U.S. Permanently or temporarily.
And Christy, any closing thoughts? You have about 2 minutes.
I have like 1,000 things running through my head. So thanks for that. It certainly has been a really challenging time to be a foreign national here in the United States over these last 4 years. It's been a challenging time to be an immigration attorney, I would say, over these last 4 years. Just to really piggyback off of what Anita said, I would advise foreign nationals to try and make sure any information that they're getting is from a legitimate, vetted, legal source. So it's very easy to get caught up in that rhetoric, as someone mentioned before, as to hear the stories of your friends and maybe worst case scenarios that are happening. But it's important to know what's true, what's really going on, what are the laws that are being enacted that's maybe in a future state versus what's the reality of going on right now. Sometimes we have foreign nationals whose cases are going great, perfect, no problems at all, but then they hear about their friend's case that got a denial. And it's a worst case scenario, and we get it. I mean, this is why we've dedicated our lives and our careers to immigration. We want to make things as smooth and easy as possible, but it is easy to get caught up in the fear that has been instilled in our immigration world for the last few years. So, I just caution people to make sure you're going to, vetted sources and to, to understand what's really changing. And then maybe just from a personal perspective, I so appreciate this opportunity to be able to speak on the subject that we're all so passionate about. My team and I have a long night ahead of us getting as many green card applications filed as humanly possible into the Immigration Service and the sealed FedEx by Friday morning. And I just, as I'm, looking at all of these applications that are going through, I have often told the story that I moved from one side of Santa Clara to another a few years ago, and it was traumatic. It was, it took so much time and effort, and there was anxiety there. And then I'm so humbled to work with foreign nationals who are moving from one side of the world to another. They don't know what their boss is going to be like. They don't know what their, day-to-day job is going to be like. And we just, I think everyone on the panel would agree. We're just so honored to be able to be a piece of that journey and that bravery that foreign nationals are, are taking on just to make, not only Silicon Valley, but the world, a better place and technology on the cutting edge of technology in the U.S.
Well, I'd like to thank each of you for joining us. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. Tonight, we've been talking about business immigration. Our guests have been Justin Falk, lead attorney of Falk Immigration Law, Anita Komrikian, partner and attorney at Alcorn Immigration, Christy Neverez, a partner at the Santa Clara office of Fragoman Worldwide, and Sajar Rauf, the principal at Sajar Rauf, Inc., a professional corporation in San Francisco. Next week, again at our time, new time at 6 o'clock, a program you won't want to miss, legal and political analyst Dean Johnson joins me for a wrap-up on the election. Perhaps that's optimistic. Once again, a thank you to all of our guests tonight. And at the controls, Debbie Kennedy. And our thanks to all of you for joining us. I'm Jeff Hayden. Good night. Be safe. And have a good night.
Support for KLW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.